Welcome to the Human Power Podcast, presented by Humanize Solutions and XMA. This is the place where resilience meets personal growth. I'm Scott Ward.
And I'm Serena Kirsten. Each episode, we uncover the stories of individuals who have faced life's hurdles head on, buck the trend of social trends, and emerge stronger. We're here to inspire, teach, and unlock the secrets to unleashing your potential together.
So let's get ready to dive deep into conversations that illuminate the power of resilience of the human spirit. Let's embark on this journey together. So today we're joined by the inspirational Simon Blake, OBE. Welcome to the Human Power Podcast, Simon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's amazing to have you on, Simon. Really looking forward to, you know, the next hour chatting through, you know, your career, some of your insights. And I'm sure our listeners are also really looking forward to hearing from you today. Something I just want to start with, and we're going to have a little chat around your bio, but in 2020, you were named a Global Diversity Leader or a Global Diversity Leader. What exactly does that mean?
It's a very good question. So I think there was part of a diversity list, wasn't it, which is trying to identify people who have put diversity at the heart of what they've done. And specifically, I think it was about people whose job title isn't diversity and inclusion. And I guess that's probably, you know, the thing which, if I was to look across my career, I've never been told you are the person responsible for diversity and inclusion. But in every single job, that has been the heart of what I've been trying to make sure is there.
Yes, it's an amazing accolade to be labelled as someone who's very influential in that space, especially during a time where diversity is such a hot topic, a key topic, marginalised groups, minority groups, more than ever pushing to be seen, heard and valued. You're also an OBE, awarded in 2011. Must have been a really special day for you.
The best bit about all of that was when Mum was dying, she said it was the best day of her life when she went to the palace. So, that was, which I then looked at Dad and thought, I'm sure that there might have been some moments which were supposed to top that. Actually, sorry, Dad, if you're listening. But it was one of those really important days. And I mean, the interesting bit about an OBE, of course, is that it should be a moment of pure pride, but it does actually also have that horrid tinge of empire. And so whilst, you know, it was brilliant because it was recognised around sex education, sexual reproductive rights, LGBT equality, etc., there was also that bit of me which was, is it actually right and honourable to accept an honour which, you know, hasn't broken that tie with our colonial past?
So really interesting insight. But, you know, as far as I see it, Simon, we need people like you to advocate in this space. And if it wasn't you, who would it be? You know, so I think there's definitely a balance, isn't it, around those types of awards. I remember going for my MBE with my family and it's that moment of reflection. But also, you're right, there is a tinge of how have I got here? And, you know, and you're never going to not cherish those moments or that particular day because it is special. But I actually do have an understanding of where you're coming from there.
Can I recruit you? We just set up an Excellence Not Empire campaign, but I'll do that.
All right, brilliant. I'm in.
Is this the point where I feel completely inadequate and out of the conversation? Thanks, guys.
Simon, your dedication to promoting inclusivity and understanding around mental health issues has essentially led to real significant advancements in how workplaces and communities address mental health and well-being. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
So I've got the enormous joy of leading an organisation called Mental Health First Aid England, which was set up about 16 years ago. It came out of government, actually, but originally from Australia. And what Mental Health First Aid England is about trying to move mental health away from psychiatrists, psychologists, you know, medical models into a general understanding about how do we, A, understand what mental health is, that it's an asset, it's not an illness. You know, when we talk about mental health, we often think of illness. How do we recognise the stigma that is attached and stops people talking about it? And we did a poll recently where people would rather talk to their manager about diarrhoea than about depression. Now, I'd like to talk to my manager about all sorts of things, but diarrhoea isn't one of them. Then it is about how do you actually look after your own mental health, but also spot the signs and symptoms when you see other people. So what Mental Health First Aid England has done, and I, you know, was not there at the beginning, so I didn't have the brainchild, just some of the implementation, is to make it an everyday thing which everyday usual people in sport, you know, in workplaces, you know, in schools, are talking about an understanding that we can all do things to look after our mental health, whether or not we've got a diagnosed mental illness.
Yeah, I think it's amazing in terms of some of the direct impacts, but also the indirect impacts from some of your work across obviously a variety of communities and the pivotal roles in other prominent organisations that are dedicated to youth and LGBTQ rights. Talk to us a little bit around how this has come to be, because, you know, like as you've already mentioned, this wasn't necessarily an area that you felt you were initially going to be representing, but you kind of have ended up in this space, haven't you?
I have. And I've always said my career is an accidental career. Yeah. So I went to university and was supposed to be an educational psychologist. I then fell in love, had an errant love affair, went to America. It all went wrong. I came back, worked in a pub, had missed the deadline, and the rest has really been accidental. So my gap year, I was 50 this year, still on a gap year from becoming an educational psychologist. But I had already, I guess, started at university doing some of the things which have marked the rest of my career. So we set up the sexual health awareness group, which was because HIV was obviously, we were in fairly early stages of the epidemic at that stage, and students were not, you know, in any way knowledgeable. And one of my friends was in the union and was like, come on, Simon, we need you to come and persuade people to do some things. And I then got a job as a sex educator. Bear in mind that I'd never had a conversation about sex with my mum, my dad. School sex education had been appalling. So how anybody trusted me to start running a sex education project is beside me. But it was brilliant. And it was one of the best first sex education projects specifically targeting young men in the country. And then moved to London to take that work and to spread the learning on a national programme outside of South Wales. And then got involved in health and wellbeing in children's sector because I had become director of the Sex Education Forum at the National Children's Bureau, which tried to bring together people to build consensus. So the churches, Terence Higgins Trust, Brooke, and then parents and governor associations sort of in the middle. And I guess what that taught me through all of this is there will always be people on the edges who cannot have conversations, but actually 80% of people in the middle don't have to agree with every single thing. You know, we don't all have to believe the same, to think the same, to like the same ice cream, but we can respect other people's choices to do that, or people's beliefs and values. At the moment, there is a risk that we've forgotten how to have conversations because it's all very transactional, online shouting rather than genuine dialogue and conversation. We want everything in bullet points.
It's amazing. It's amazing insight, I think, with what you're saying around this fast living society, right? It's like we can't concentrate on anything anymore. Netflix series are now 22 minutes because apparently the world underestimates us as humans and we couldn't possibly watch anything more than an hour long. And you're right, you know, and I think the work that you're doing in this space is encouraging us to get back to that more traditional way of operating, right? The more human way around conversation and face-to-face and listening and respecting. So, yeah, while social media and the internet and the digital world gives us everything at our fingertips, I do think what you're doing is almost enabling people to understand that we all have a responsibility around getting that balance right between using it, but also making sure that we're respecting others in the world, right?
Absolutely that. But and also understanding that we've got the way our brain works. So, you know, it's taken me, I know, an hour or so to get here today. And so I was reflecting and joining dots. And that wouldn't have happened if I'd gone from the Teams meeting to the Google Meet to the Zoom and then, you know, off out. So there is also something about recognizing the way that our brains work, you know, that walking and connecting and prepping and going to meetings and having the building the relationship between people is a critical part of well-being. Yeah, digital is brilliant, thank goodness for it. Can you imagine, you know, that time through COVID without it? But there is nothing better than relationships and conversations and face-to-faceness.
Yeah, and speaking of relationships, I did read in another interview, are you talking quite fondly of your granny and around she believes in 8 hours of work, 8 hours of play and 8 hours of sleep, and that's kind of how we should operate. And I thought that was a really warm quote and, you know, what a great piece of advice from obviously someone quite close to your heart around how her view of the world, essentially.
I mean, and arguably a little bit simplistic, but it's the thing that sticks in my brain as the thing, you know, as she said it, that you've got to work, you've got to sleep, you've got to play. Ironically, hers was because she wanted me to stay up later because I like going to bed at 6 in the evening and Mum wanted me to be awake when I got home.
So she had her own agenda then.
Yeah. Simon, I think this leads really nicely on to the next subject. And thanks again for being with us today. I want to talk about something that would have pushed you mentally, physically, emotionally in a time where there was so much uncertainty in the world. COVID comes. Predominantly a face-to-face business, as we've all just agreed, that is about interaction, face-to-face communication. What went through your mind and how was that for you trying to make sense of a time where people were completely dependent on you, the service you provide, knowing the cascade of trauma that would be following such a horrendous time in our lifetimes?
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because we now know what we know, you know, and at the time we only knew what we knew, which I know sounds really silly, but with hindsight, yeah, we literally, as a social enterprise, stopped trading because we didn't have anything that was face to face. So what we said to people was, if you know how to use that thing called Zoom, you can do our 3-hour courses online immediately. So we operate through an instructor member network. So people started doing that. And then very quickly we're saying, okay, we're going to have to adapt everything so it goes online. And at the time, people weren't doing much online. So he had our instructor members who were saying, you can't do this digitally because it won't be effective. It's not good practice. Like most things, you don't quite know until after the impact. And I was also, you know, vice chair of Stonewall at the time. My partner was a dentist and has an 8 practice business. So we actually had those 3 things going on. And I remember now feeling incredibly tired, you know, most of the time, sitting at home making decisions about whether you were going to furlough people or not, and thinking, you know, we need twice the number of people we've got to do this transition, but we need the furlough money in order to be able to survive that next moment. The mantra was, there is no easy answer, there is the least worst answer. You know, when you are making a decision, so to adopt that mindset of, there isn't perfect here, and actually we don't have the luxury of time, became a way to get through. Exercise was incredible. I mean, I remember crying when Boris Johnson said we had to be locked in and we'd have that hour a day as a you know, Cornish kid that grew up, you know, being dragged indoors when you had to and hating being indoors at any opportunity. The one thing which I did do was make sure that I used every second of that hour that we had every day to get out and just try to process something, go without a phone, you know, without earphones, and just try to make sense of the world in that moment, give the brain a rest.
In your journey, you've obviously faced and overcome significant challenges, whether this was professional or personal. What tools, tips, tricks, advice could you give to our listeners listening here today?
The bit which I have to really be thankful for is that my brain has always been very, very good to me, in that I've experienced all sorts of things, but it, you know, I've always had that sense of it will be okay. And I think partly that's down to my upbringing. My mum was always very clear, there's nothing that's too big or too small to talk about. I had a very strong friendship group at school, but I also was bullied or seen as different is probably a better word. I'd love to go back and actually know what it really was, but certainly there was a sense that I was different and people named me as being gay before I knew that I was gay myself. And I also had horses. And so boys didn't really have horses in that context, but the farmer down the road had lots of horses and gave me a pony to look after. And then he had a load of others, which I viewed as mine. So it was part of a weird childhood that I grew up, very swallows and Amazons in some ways. But I think what that did was just meant that we had the opportunity to experience risk and to overcome certain things. It was before mobile phones. It was before people could connect with you. We would run off. We would push each other in the stream. We didn't have all of the safety rules that are here. So I think there is something which we have to understand about the way that we are now and the way that we've been and work out how we get the best of both worlds. But I would definitely say lots of my resilience as an adult is down to my very early experiences of being able to muck around, get things right, and know that there was always a backstop.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating to hear around how some of those earlier experiences have shaped who you are today. And it sounds like your mother's an incredible woman, by the way. What a generous farmer, you know. Maybe I'll try that in Jersey next week, go down and see if I can borrow a horse, because I love horses too. So we share that passion. I just want to talk around, obviously, you mentioned there around kids calling you gay before you even knew you were gay. And then you grew up in the 80s as a gay man. Can you just talk to us around what that was like? You know, I've seen It's a Sin, a game-changing series for me. What an eye-opener to some of the struggles, but also the powerful characters that were around in that time. What were some of the challenges that you faced as an individual growing up, you know, in the 80s? And was there anyone who inspired you, or, you know, what was your support network like around helping to shape who you are now? And, you know, you've obviously found yourself in that space representing, you know, the whole gay community, but just really curious around what that experience was like for you.
It's a really interesting one. I think It's a Sin is important because it, for those who don't know, it's a program around at the early phase of HIV. And what it showed was how closely joy and pain live together. Yeah, that excitement, the anticipation, the fun of finding a gay scene. Yeah, if you remember the first time that you kissed somebody that you really, 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 really fancied, and you bristle in all sorts of ways. Yeah, as a gay man, the first time you kiss a man, having kissed lots of women, it's like, oh, that's what people are going on about. But you're obviously in a different environment and you're at a different age, and you connect with people on a different sort of level in a context where there was a lot more homophobia. I mean, if you think about the front pages of the newspaper at that time. So I guess what you learn from everything around you is gay men are pretty awful. You know, and then if you're starting to go, okay, I think I might be gay, you're going, oh, well, that might mean that I'm awful. Oh, right, so I'm going to be promiscuous. I'm going to be, you know, not safe around other people. Oh, these are the things that are going to happen. So they can become monsters in your head. And in some way they do, but I guess I've metabolized it, you know, in some ways. And perhaps part of the work around social justice is my payback for, you know, being lucky enough to have come out the other side. I remember thinking, oh, yeah, maybe I'll die really early. Maybe I'll get HIV. And almost like, you know, just by being gay, you're going to get HIV. And at that point, of course, that was about dying, not living with. So it would be easy to say it wasn't hard. And it would be easy to say it was really hard. The reality of it was you just got up in the morning, felt absolutely awful at some parts of the day, felt really excited at other parts of the day, and had to have some really difficult conversations. You know, and I remember talking to mum and dad, and mum by this point hadn't, as far as she knew, met anybody else who was gay. And we grew up in Cornwall, very small village. Dad had met one person that he knew was gay. So dad was much more understanding and thought it was possible to, you know, to live a happy, fulfilled life. But mum was really worried that I wouldn't. That's quite a lot to take on. But over time, you know, that all changes. And the same at university, you know, the hiding, the ducking and the diving and not telling people where you've been is awful, because these people that you're spending all of your time with, also I wasn't brave enough. You know, there were some people who were right up front straight away, but I wasn't. And the sad thing is that despite the progress that we've made, there are still lots and lots and lots of children, young people and adults who still feel that now, because even when the world is a bit more accepting, in the context of families often or friendship groups, there is just the expectation that we will be heterosexual, cisgendered, you know, able to do X, Y, Z. So yeah, and that's when it comes to diversity, it is about being human, isn't it? It's so easy for people to go, this is about race or about gender or about sexuality or about disability. But actually it's about, yeah, a human being who's able to look in the mirror and think, yeah, I'm worthy of being valued and of equal value, and I will be able to get out in the world without the barriers which currently exist.
Yeah, I think an incredible story, really. And you're right, labels unfortunately create these stigmas and these stereotypes, right? And we're constantly running around trying to not be put in a box, but also have a label and have an identity and find out where we fit. I'm really curious around how like navigating your way through that. And you mentioned there around kind of that light bulb moment where people feel brave enough or have the courage to go, no, this is who I am, and being more comfortable with, you know, the world being comfortable with them, essentially. When did that moment change for you, do you think? Was it something that happened within your career, or was it an environment that you shifted into? Was it a group of people that felt like enabled you more to step into that space more comfortably?
It was all of those things. It was definitely people. So the first people I told at uni were like, thank God you've told us. There was also a moment where I was like, do you know what? Life is too short, actually. If I am with people who don't want to be, to like me because of something which I have no control over, then actually that isn't a place that I want to exist. So I think a combination of time, actually getting the words for it. I mean, I would love to know when I said to myself, I am gay. I don't remember the moment, but I remember all sorts of feelings about all sorts of people and all sorts of crushes for a very long time before I even started putting the pieces together. And again, it's that bit, isn't it? It'd be so nice to rewatch what actually happened, because all I've got now is this reconstructed jumble of things. But I do remember going round to dinner, and it was with a friend who was a lesbian on the course, and it was dinner and I was hours late, and I just met, so it was to become my first boyfriend. And I made up this cock and bull story. I can't even remember what it was. And at the end of it, she went, Simon, why were you really late when everybody else had gone? I told him, say, oh, thank goodness that there was a real sensible reason. And Sarah was a lesbian. She'd been out for ages. Why I hadn't told her, you know, just privately in the room, it was, you know, before WhatsApp, etc. I had learned, and lots of us learn, that bit of people will judge you, people won't like you, and so then finding ways to protect yourself is really important. But ultimately, the moment that I was like, the only way I can protect myself is by making sure that people know who I am. And if they don't like who I am, then I make decisions and choices about that, rather than hide who I am in order for people to like somebody who isn't really me.
For any of our listeners that may be going through a time of questioning where they are with their sexuality and whether they can or can't trust those around them, what do you think is a good way to at least broach the subject with yourself before others in allowing them to do that? Because as you said, you know, in all walks of life, this is still a huge, huge challenge for many, and really for something that I think many of us just really struggle to understand because we haven't been through ourselves.
I guess the first thing is not to rush it. I think that so often we want to get to the other end. And I remember reading a book in preparation for coming out to my mum and dad, which probably tells you again a bit about who I am, but it's When Your Child Comes Out. And there was a sentence in it which said, your child will have taken years to get to grips with this, so don't expect yourself to move from thinking they were straight, you know, through to understanding they're gay and explain to them in the same way that it's taken them a while to be brave enough to talk to you. Yeah, it's going to take us a bit of time to adjust as well. And I found that, you know, one of those moments of, aha, actually, we can't, you know, our worlds don't change and then we suddenly adjust. And whether it's right or wrong that, you know, my parents grew up thinking that I was heterosexual, you know, in that it is what was expected, yeah, and therefore their world shifted. I guess the reason that I say that is the first thing is be gentle with it. You know, don't push it, don't rush it, give yourself time, but also don't be afraid of it. Find someone you trust, and that might be your closest friend. It might be your brother, and just have those conversations. Obviously, there are all sorts of online forms of support. I guess what I would just say is don't let anybody view, say, you need to go to a counsellor. So often people think, oh, there's a problem, when actually what you need to know is it isn't a problem. I might have to get to terms with it. I might have to think about it. I might have to understand it, but I am not a problem. And finding your way through with that mindset of not allowing homophobia and other prejudice to make you think that you're a problem is, I think, probably one of the most important things. And it will unfold. I'm 50. I still come out at least once a day to somebody for some reason, you know, either knowingly or unknowingly. And I say that, as I say, I sort of sigh, but there is also a bit which is actually what enormous privilege to be able to do that. You know, it was my 50th birthday a few weeks ago, went to the bar. The person who ran the bar was gay, but still insisted that I had a wife. And I'm like, come on. But I just say that because it doesn't, yeah, I'm still doing it now. I'm still making sense of some stuff. I'm not in the same way that I did when I was 14, 18 or 22, but it never ends in the same way that your story just keeps on unraveling, doesn't it?
That process of self-discovery can't be rushed, can it? Because it's you, it's not somebody else's interpretation of happiness.
Yeah. As you know, Scott, my brother died when he was 45. And one of the things that I often think is, I wonder what I would have done differently, or he would have done differently, or we as a family would have done differently if we'd known that you only had that amount of time. But we didn't know. So we did the best of what we can. And it's that thing, isn't it, of how do you give yourself time and not rush, but recognize we don't have infinite time. Yeah, and that not wasting it. Yeah, whatever we do, not wasting it. So if taking the time is taking away from what might be joy and happiness, a bit quicker, then see how you can get there.
Amazing insight, really. And you speak a lot around, all the different ways that you found your way through. And in this next segment, we like to talk about our guests, so your resilience recipe. So some of the, secret strategies or, routines that you've relied upon to get yourself through some challenges.
I used to go and sit with a woman called Edith O'Brien every Sunday when I was growing up. It's a woman that lived down the road from us. So every Sunday from I was about 9 until she died. And her hindsight was my foresight. and I wish that we had much more intergenerational conversation, because without me even knowing, there were moments where I was like, Miss O'Brien's treacle right now would be this, and you have that sort of those moments in your mind where it's like, oh, that's when I needed to learn this for. So that would be one bit for resilience is if we could, it's great for older people, and it's also great for children and younger people to have those relationships. I think if we could nurture that, it would be amazing. The second would be to trust yourself and to trust why you decide to do something or not to do something. Listen to your belly. That gut feeling, it gives you the warnings that sometimes we ignore. And every time you ignore it afterwards, with hindsight, should have listened. There is something really important and powerful in that. Make sure that there are people around you who you trust, and be really present in those relationships. And one of my ongoing struggles is that I do too much, and in doing too much, I sometimes don't spend enough time doing the things which are really, really important. And this is where I start sounding perhaps a little bit nerdy. We need to understand enough about our brain to know how to look after it so it can look after us. Back to granny, making sure that you have got enough sleep, making sure that we have got enough water, the good food as much as you can possibly have. Getting the basics right, listening to your body, always having movement, always having the right people around you, making sure that you have time for the things you love, and dance like a fool. that sense of, for me, loud music and dancing in the kitchen. It used to be going clubbing till 6 in the morning. Now it's dancing for 7 minutes and getting out of breath in the kitchen. But that sense of, when do you lose yourself? And my chair, Ada Paris, chair of MHFA England, is really, really reminded me that sense of losing yourself in music or in sound or, in something is incredibly important. Because in the same way that you wouldn't do physical exercise 24 hours a day, we can't expect our brain to do mental exercise 24 hours a day. We have to actively find ways to let it have a rest.
Dance like a fool. You heard it here first, everyone. Dance like a fool. I love that one, because I think, what I love the most about that is that as adults, we're just on one thing to the next, aren't we? It's like, work, and then everything's got to be scheduled in. And then a lot of us have kids. So it's kind of like, is it your night? Is it my night? And then you're at dinner, but you're constantly thinking about something else. I find that as a struggle as a mother. I'm like, I want to be away, but I also want to be close, and I want to have a career and have goals, but also want to be there for my kids. And there's all these constant tensions. So actually, those moments where I was in my 20s and I had the opportunity to be spontaneous and, you know, be a little bit more crazy in some of like my lifestyle choices. I don't have that anymore because I've got responsibilities and I wouldn't want to live that lifestyle anymore. So, yeah, I think those moments of joy, you know, even if it's just 7 minutes, like you say, in the kitchen and we pull a calf muscle on our backs, but it's all very much worth it, isn't it?
I think so. And during COVID, I coined a phrase for myself. I'm sure somebody had coined it via it, which is about a promise to myself to create a spike of joy for myself and for somebody else every day. Yeah. And whether that was sending a postcard, whether that was dancing in the kitchen, and I've kept that. And actually, the other thing that I do, the first thing I do when I wake up in the morning, before I even open my eyes, go, right, what are the three things that you're grateful for? And sometimes they're big and really meaningful. And sometimes they're, oh, I'm grateful for the fact that I woke up this morning. What's interesting, I guess, in that is that none of the things which I've said are things which I feel like I am enslaved to. They are things which are just little habits, which I completely forgot about that because it's effortless. But to begin with, it took effort. How we can find ways to do little things, whether that's to stand up and, you know, shake in between each podcast that you're recording today, or, you know, making sure that you have one stick of broccoli when you are eating your fizzy sweets or whatever it is, you know, that you build in those bits of goodness into everything that we're doing.
There, obviously, we've focused a lot around self-practice, self-reflection. In this part of the podcast, Simon, we look at unlocking human potential, and somebody in yourself that's held some really senior positions and had many look upwards at you for inspiration and advice in times of need. What's one major lesson or insight that you've not shared previously that you feel is key to unlocking that human potential? And this could be anything around something small that our listeners can actually attach themselves to, or something momentous that actually has assisted you in reframing the way that you see things and others around you.
I think there are three things. The first is always surround yourself with people who are good at the things that you are not, and really value those people and make sure that you're creating the conditions in which they shine. That is good for them, but it also, that sense of knowing that as a leader, you don't have all the answers. You don't need to know everything, as long as you've got good quality people around you who are able to have conversations with you and to test things. The second is to make sure that we have time to think. The world of work now is very different than it was when I started. I didn't have an email address, which meant that on my way into work, I wasn't thinking I'm going to open my laptop and see what's in my email inbox. It was, what am I going to do today? And so often we talk about that as the ideal way to work, but how many people actually practice that? So we can be really busy and still have a full inbox by the end of the day and done nothing that actually helps you achieve something. So getting that clarity about what does it actually mean to deliver the work that we need to do. And the reason that I say that in the context of unlocking human potential is I'm not sure that we've clocked that we are in an environment where it is possible to be busy, busy to the point of feeling stressed and overwhelmed without going anywhere near achieving what is actually going to be best for the business. So if we have that in our conscious minds, then we can help induct people and train people and support people to work well and not to be just, you know, doing whatever's coming up from other people's to-do list in the email inbox. And the third would be really recognizing that there are lots of different ways to achieve something. I was appalling at this through my 20s, thought it was either my way because I was brilliant, you know, at understanding and thinking about things, or it wasn't the right way. Whereas what I now know is that there are lots of different ways. And so when somebody asks you to think about something or support them, it's, what is it that I'm doing that adds value into this? Or am I just giving feedback or adjusting in to try to make it more like me? And we've seen that so many times. If you don't say to people, actually, your way is a really, really good way of doing things, whether that's about using PowerPoint slides, you know, went from no PowerPoint slides, or those acetates, whatever it was, you know, to PowerPoint. You had to do a PowerPoint. The PowerPoint had to have stats on it, to suddenly, you know, less words, or yeah, now just pictures. Yeah, there isn't a right way of doing it. For some people, just sitting and listening to them is amazing. For others, having, you know, a group of slides which give you brilliant statistics is going to be the best way for them presenting. So what is actually making something better, and what is just making something a bit more like you would have done it if you were doing that job?
And can I just lead on from that quickly? I think it brings us to a point, a really interesting point actually, which I think a lot of organizations and senior leaders are suffering from at the moment post-COVID, is how can you try to bring people, if it's realistic and progressive, back to the office in an accountable way where there is clearly at times a reluctance to do so in this new day and age? Because we're finding that when we're out there speaking to a lot of people in senior positions, there is a real tug of war of wanting their people back because they understand it's best to optimize the organization. But from an employee perspective, often they're actually not really willing to come back in the full time that they used to before.
I'm really worried about this because from a mental health at work perspective, there is no doubt that this is one of our greatest challenges of our time. And now, I am not a person who believes that 5 days in the office is the right and only way of doing it. And I love the fact that Mondays, you know, I can slouch to the kitchen table and not have to get up, which they're doing, you know, quite often. But one of the things that protected people's mental health from work was the fact that home, for lots of people, most people hopefully, is a safe place. It wasn't a place where you'd had the difficult conversations, where you'd felt overwhelmed with work, where you had a difficult conversation about something or struggled with a piece of work. So you would go home and there would be a distance. So that benefit of movement, you know, which we know helps. And then when you got in, there's a door between you and the work. And so often we're saying, come back to the office. What I want to be saying is create a space at home, which is a space which gives you some distance from work. And most of us, I don't think, have that luxury. Actually, you know, certainly in London, you know, very few people are going to have, you know, an office, whether that's in the house or a garden shed. Yeah, so there will be all sorts of things. So for me, I think there's something here which is really, really respecting the flexibility and autonomy and all those things which people are wanting and loving, but also having honest conversations about what does it mean to have your computer at your kitchen table all of the time. A, from a musculoskeletal basis, and we know that the way that we sit affects the way that we think, right the way through to, if I don't clear away the laptop when I go to bed, the last thing that I see as I go to get a glass of water, a cup of tea, or whatever it is the computer. And our brain makes a connection. You may think that it's under a pile of books or it's behind the fruit bowl or whatever it is, but actually our brain goes, I forgot, or, oh, I remember. And so we somehow have to work together to find a way to minimize those unintended consequences of what is obviously a good thing. Flexibility has to be a good thing. But if people are not wanting to go into the office because of either social anxiety, because it wasn't nice for them, because they experienced harassment or bullying, you know, those things are not going to be addressed by saying we can all stay at home. Those things have to be addressed as part of, we think about what's going forward. There isn't any going back, really, really clear about that. But how the conversation about workplace mental health cannot all be about how we provide support at the point people are stressed, it's got to be how do we remove the stressors and how do we use what we know about neuroscience and about the way our brains work to have honest conversations and then get the balance, yeah, absolutely right. And you know, it's interesting when you go into your computer, isn't it, where it says, send this within normal working hours. Well, if we're really committed to flexibility, normal working hours is not 9 to 5, and then anyone outside of that is wrong. It is normal working hours. And if that means that you're sat at your phone at 9:30 and you're looking at your emails, then you've made that your working hour. Yeah, that's not my responsibility to pretend that I wasn't working at 9:30 and to put on a hide until 8 o'clock. But we're not willing to have those sorts of conversations about how do we take personal accountability and business accountability to find ways to work it through. If you're willing to put on your phone, you know, I'm out of work or whatever it is, so that it doesn't send your emails through. Yeah, there are all sorts of things that the tech does for us, but we can't say we want flexibility and then really say what we mean is we want to do it exactly the same as we have with a few tweaks to it. I think we're really looking at whole scale change.
I think what I'm interested in around everything you've just been talking about, Simon, is the brain and the neuroscience. And we know that you're the man in the room who can probably share with our listeners just some of the science behind how this affects the capacity to build resilience and potentially come over some of these challenges, but also kind of maintaining that positive mindset that everybody is hoping to achieve long term. How is this affecting us? Can you share some insights around? Because I think our listeners will be really, you know, keen to hear around some of the impacts and some of the science behind it, because I don't think it's shared enough. And I'm not sure how informed actually the nation is around some of the consequences of their decision making around flexible working and working from home. You know, obviously, you get a lot of, you know, first time mothers who then move more into flexible working and things like that. So sometimes it's forced upon you in a sense when you come to kind of building families and things like that. And men as well, obviously, he will move into a, you know, a bit of a hybrid role when families and children come along. But what are the consequences of this and how can our listeners best navigate it?
Okay, so we've got 4.5 hours, right? The first thing that I would say is actively thinking about it and really, really trying to work out what does a balanced life look like for me? And you talked earlier about, you know, all of those different pressures, wanting to do this and wanting to do that. We can't do everything. So how do we act? What is going to be good and right for us at this moment in time? And then where does work fit within that? But the first thing to say would be really, really thinking about and understanding it and asking ourselves, what are we thinking? What are we feeling? Yeah, how are we sleeping? How is my mood being affected? Yeah, and asking ourselves those questions about things. There's then the bit about understanding the science. So I am no scientist, but the basic thing which I think all of us really need to understand is that we have a stress container, all of us. And that might be really big or really small or somewhere in between. And stress is cumulative. So, you know, if you get up and you're late and you then spill something down your top and you then have a difficult meeting and then you drop tomato ketchup down your shirt, it might be the tomato ketchup down your shirt that is the thing which makes you really, really tips you over the edge on that particular moment. But it's not the tomato ketchup, it's the cumulative impact of all of those things. So our job as humans at its most simple is to manage our stress container. It doesn't just keep on rising if we take active steps. So think about it like a bath. You know, you can pull the tap, pull the plug up, you know, and let some of that out by doing things we love, talking to people, getting support, asking for help, reducing the number of things that we do. And also thinking then about where we do things, how we do things, is really, really important. And those are the bits which I don't think people are thinking about enough is what does it mean to do work things in an office or at home? How do I make this work for me in a way? And we will, the beauty and the challenge is that we are all different. What will work for you won't work for me because I don't have a child. You know, I like cycling, you know, whatever it is, you know, and it's, so it's all of that bit of how do we put all of this together? But at its most simple, taking time to think about what is it that gives me joy? What is it that makes me happy? What are the things which create challenge and stress and overwhelm? And how do I manage that in the context of work and the rest of my life? We worry so much about connection. But actually, when is the time when we just allow ourselves to disconnect? You know, that it doesn't matter what's on Twitter. It doesn't matter what's on Facebook. It doesn't matter, you know, what's on Instagram or LinkedIn or wherever it is, or the news cycle. I mean, my phone has been, my watch, because I don't know how to disconnect it, has been buzzing all the way through telling me things, which I don't want to know. You know, I can find out when I want to go and look for them. Some people have the luxury of time more than others, but how do we use the time that we do have consciously and deliberatively in order to give ourselves, you know, the best chance of keeping well?
Simon, I think that's been an amazing insight into your philosophy. And to be honest, the reason why often when people talk about you, they do so with a smile. I think you bring a real rigor and happiness to the room and give people the opportunity to feel safe when talking around you as well. And that's a real unique talent that you offer. This part of the podcast, as we're coming towards the end, we like to ask, Sarina and I like to ask you probably the most difficult question of your week.
This is exciting.
After everything you faced, providing, let's be honest, hope to others, supporting them through their own journeys, what do you feel that your human power is?
I guess to not be surprised, but also to not undervalue the uniqueness to an individual. I'm often asked by friends or friends of friends' parents to have a conversation with either parent or a child who might be coming out. And there is either a rush to make it really big or to make it really small, when actually there is a right size for that person at that particular moment in time. So the flip side of me not being surprised is that sometimes it can feel like I just go, oh. But actually then, you know, sort of in it will lean into recognizing, you know, that sometimes things which feel really big to somebody, you may just think, wow, why does that feel big to you? Or feels really little to them. You're like, that's the biggest thing that there is. So I would like to think, one of my strengths is not being succinct, is it? But would like to think that it's about finding a way to sit with whatever person is wanting you to sit with.
That was pretty succinct.
In the end.
After an hour.
No, look, in all seriousness, I think it's been amazing to have you on, and thank you so much for being so open around some of your personal and your professional challenges and how it shaped you into this incredible human being that you are today. So really amazing to sit here, and what a privilege for us to listen to you. And I'm sure our listeners feel exactly the same. In terms of just some of the key takeaways and some of my favourite and our favourite bits from today, I really love what you just said around disconnecting to reconnect almost, and the importance of that and actually taking the time to do that. You mentioned at the beginning around surrounding yourself with people who are better than you, whether that's from a leadership perspective, but also from a professional and learning and development perspective, and giving yourself that time to think so you can make good, clear decisions, and how important that is. Something that I don't think is shared enough, and I love this, mental health is an asset, not an illness. I think that is just a narrative that we all need to take by the, you know, bull by the horns and run with it, because that completely reframes the whole subject, doesn't it, really? Just that one statement. So I think that's really powerful and something our listeners can take away with. Creating change through conversation. And I think this is, you know, the definition of you in essence, with some of the, not only your experiences, but the spaces that you're operating in within the community and young people. And nothing too big or small to talk about. I said at the beginning, your mother's an incredible woman, and what a piece of advice to be able to take into your life and your career for the next 50 years. Finally, you know, you speak around this support networks and environment and the importance of that, and almost that mentorship and making sure that you've got that support network. It was Edith O'Brien for you, maybe indirectly, but, you know, we've all got them, haven't we? And they're all in pockets. We might not even realise what's happening until they're gone, or, you know, it's 25 years later and you think, wow, gosh, that's what they were telling me. So look, lots of incredible reflections and insights. And yeah, I've just wow, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We truly hope that today's guest has offered you, our listeners, the opportunity to explore your own journey of self-reflection, personal empathy and success. Remember, it's important to share your stories of struggle and success with those around you. Let's unlock potential together.
Thanks for tuning in to the Human Powered Podcast. It's been a privilege to share today's journey of resilience and empowerment with you. Remember, each story we share is a step towards understanding our own true potential. Follow Humanized Solutions on social media to become part of our growing community, and don't hesitate to share your own experiences. I'm Scott.
And I'm Sarina, reminding you that within each of us lies untapped strength. Let's unlock it together. Until next time, keep striving, keep believing, and keep growing.